For the week of January 29th, 2017, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 353, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Birmingham, Alabama, I'm Michael Giltz. How y'all doing?
You know, you always do that when you're in Birmingham. Somehow you pick up a little bit of a tinge, a little bit of a twang.
I drink a little sweet tea and it all just comes pouring out.
Is that like the law in Birmingham, Alabama? Do you have to eat barbecue and drink sweet tea all the time?
Actually, this is funny. I go to Panera Bread kind of regularly and Cozy. Those are two of my schlubby little places where I spend 4 or 5 hours a day working and I live there, you know, places they don't mind if you linger. And at Panera, you know when you're coming down south because you cross the Mason-Dixon line and suddenly the Paneras have sweet tea. They all have iced tea and green tea and lemonade, whatever. But when you get down south, they also have, you know, unsweetened iced tea, and then they have sweet tea as another option. It's already done, sweet tea. And I mix the two, and there you go. You go up north, you know you're back north because there's no sweet tea. It's just iced tea. This is tea that they make every day. And I'm always like, well, you think people up north don't want sweet tea? Suddenly they stop, you know, whatever. And then why don't you have them at all the same place? It seems silly. And I wrote an email. I wrote an email to Panera saying, hey, you know, you've got them down south. I don't know why you don't have them everywhere. Sometimes they have hibiscus purple tea. And I'm like, really? You think that's more popular than sweet tea? You know, why not just have both options at every place? They added sweet tea in Allentown, Pennsylvania, where my brother is. I was like, oh my God, sweet tea, it worked. I emailed them and like 3 weeks later, there is sweet tea in Allentown, Pennsylvania. I couldn't believe it. I drive down south to Birmingham. I go to Panera and they don't have sweet tea anymore. I'm like, what? I go to the pantry. I go, what? And he's like, yeah, they just switched that. The pump is there. You can add. I go, but they just added sweet tea up north. And he's like, what? my head is blown. I don't know where I am anymore.
And for those of you who may not live in the U.S. or may not even know what sweet tea is, it is not just tea with sugar in it. It is a very specific kind of tea, and it has a very specific flavor, and it's kind of addictive.
It's classic tea, but with a lot of sugar.
Yes, pretty much. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's my story at Panera, and that's probably where I'll be writing notes for the next show when I do it during the week. But we've already got this show going on, and what are we going to talk about?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we'll be joined by Ann Thompson of IndieWire, who is just back from the Sundance Film Festival in Park City, Utah. We'll ask her about all the indie films that created buzz, which films were picked up by distributors, and all the titles we should look for over the next year or two, including many that may not even make it into theaters. Thank you, Netflix. As we know, Ann also covers the awards season, so maybe she has a thing or two to say about the SAG and PGA awards, which were handed out over the weekend. During our book filter segment, Michael, you're going to share your pick for the book Hollywood should be snapping up right now. Keywords this week are strippers and Anderson Cooper. I can't wait. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the rest of the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. And we're looking at box office from around the world. We have a link to ComScore in our show notes. That's where we go to start with to build our list. But then we also go to The Hollywood Reporter, Variety, LA Times, New York Times, Box Office Profits, Box Office Mojo. And of course, it's a new year. In Asian communities all over the world are celebrating the Chinese New Year. And so Happy New Year to everybody. Again, the ceremonies and the parties and fun are still going on. It'll go through, you know, early February. And that means a lot of big movies opened up in a lot of territories. And that's why the number one film around the world is Journey to the West, The Demon Strikes Back. It's a Chinese sequel to Journey to the West. And of course, it's about the Monkey King based on their classic myth. $85 million worldwide in 7 territories. So that was a big, big opening for that movie.
You know, I was walking past the television set here at home the other day. And the kids were watching The Librarians. I think it's on TBS or TNT.
Just renewed for another season, I believe.
Yes. And they were, the characters were on the screen fighting some other character, some obviously evil character, and all of a sudden the character turned into a monkey, and I said, oh my gosh, they just stole that from The Monkey King, like Journey to the West, like, looked exactly the same.
I don't know if stole, it's an illusion, it's an homage.
Okay, well, it certainly looked a lot alike.
Yeah, right, of course they know that, they did it purposefully.
Okay.
Yeah. And so another big movie in Asian communities all over the world, Buddies in India. This is a Chinese comedy about two guys looking for a will. It's a road trip sort of movie, I think. $45 million on its opening weekend. So, you know, obviously Journey to the West did almost double that. That was a huge opening. And that was like, I believe, the highest grossing Chinese language film of all time at one point, the original Journey to the West. So that was a big, big movie. This one is a very strong launch, though, $45 million on its opening weekend. And number three is Resident Evil, the final chapter. But will it be? Because it made $42 million over the weekend. It's just at about $80 million. It made a lot of money overseas last time, and that's exactly what it might do again this time. And it's only a $40 million budget. And number four is the M. Night Shyamalan second comeback movie. Is it a comeback anymore? Or is he comebacked by now?
I think this definitely is a comeback. I mean, it's made $26 million. I mean, he's already up to like $80 million on this film in 2 weeks. Yeah, I guess what was the last one? It was a horror film.
The Arrival or not The Arrival.
The Gift.
The Gift?
Was it The Gift? It was the something. It was, obviously, we didn't know. We didn't see it.
Horror is like my one really blind spot. I'm just not really into horror. It just doesn't interest me.
I'm with you. I don't know why, because obviously they're incredibly...
The Visit is the movie that he...
I knew it
Visit.
Had the word "the" in it. Does that count?
Sure. Yeah, so I think this is the second in a comeback. So, I think it's comebacked.
Yes. Okay.
So,
well,
Split made $41 million over the weekend. It's at $100 million worldwide. It only cost $10 million to make. He paid for it out of his own pocket to keep full control. There you go. It's paying off handsomely. At number five, another big New Year's movie, Kung Fu Yoga. This is a Jackie Chan comedy. $40 million on its opening weekend.
You know, it's worth noting here that all of the films that open in China, there are no Hollywood films opening in China right now.
No, this 10-day, two-week period, the blackout is still very firm. They're like, yeah, okay, well, we're loosening things up, but this is our time.
Yeah, but I wonder if because of that, U.S. studios aren't opening movies here and internationally elsewhere because, you know, for piracy reasons that, you know, they'll just wait 2 weeks and open it, at the end of February when they can open in worldwide.
I don't understand. They can't. They can't open it in China. They don't have a choice.
No, but at the, 2 weeks from now, they can. After the blackout. In other words,
but they're not guaranteed. Most movies don't even have that option, right?
Yeah, that's true.
And Resident Evil's in 45 territory, so it's not like they're just sitting at home twiddling their thumbs.
No, they're counting $42 million.
Here's a really interesting movie, La La Land. $35 million over the weekend. That's what it costs to make this movie. It's at $225 million worldwide. It expanded wide in North America. It expanded all over the globe to capitalize on Oscar nominations and, of course, on wins and other award ceremonies like the Golden Globes. It's a classic pattern, open small, open wider, peg it to the award season. But I feel like they've done this on a global scale in a way I haven't really noticed for a small movie. A small movie, you know what I mean? This is not Rogue One. This is a small movie that they platformed out. And yet they have really, I think, done the award season on a global scale. And to me, that's kind of new.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. I wonder if that's been done before. It certainly wasn't done with Hurt Locker, I don't believe.
No.
But when you look at this film, you want to know what 14 Academy Award nominations get you? This film played this past weekend, La La Land, in 75 different territories.
And this is a movie that you would not think of as being a wide, worldwide, global release type movie. I mean, it has two big stars in it, Ryan Gosling and Emma Stone, but it's a musical which hasn't traveled well, and it's an original musical, a little downbeat, a little bittersweet come the romantic ending.
Spoiler alert! Spoiler!
It's in the spirit of The Umbrellas of Cherbourg. It's not a secret that it's not a la la la. You know, it's an adult film, a mature drama, a musical drama. You know, it's not a light comedy.
Okay.
There you go. But anyway, I think it's a very interesting pattern. I think what they did in the U.S., they have now done on a global scale, and I think that's kind of new. At number seven is something that's not new. You make a hit film, you should make a sequel. And they did eventually. It's XXX, The Return of Xander Cage, Vin Diesel's movie, $32 million over the weekend, $125 million worldwide. I'd forgotten, like, why wasn't he in the first sequel? Did they not want to pay it? And I looked it up, and he said he wasn't happy with the script, which is almost kind of quaint.
Yeah, remember when people cared about scripts?
I think it's just an excuse, though. I mean, he and the director backed out. Maybe they didn't want to pay their quote or something, but I just can't imagine why they didn't take their time to write a better script, or maybe it was they didn't want to pay up, or what was going on there.
That was during a time for Vin Diesel where he was kind of being very difficult. If you recall, he wasn't in the Fast and Furious sequel either, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, there you go. So maybe he fired his manager and moved on by now. Well, he's in 63 territories. This movie is not there yet, but it's on its way. We'll have to see where it ends up. Obviously, it's been programmed to do well worldwide. There's lots of international stars in that movie. At number 8 is Sing. There's going to be a sequel to this animated film. $30 million over the weekend, $460 million worldwide. At number 9 is A Dog's Purpose, which is apparently... his purpose is to be mistreated on a film set. No, they say it's more complicated than that, but you can look it up for yourself. $22 million on its opening weekend. Did that help it, or did the attention hurt it? I can't imagine it doing that much better, but who
knows?
Yeah,
I can't. I mean, I don't think this was, it made what, $18 million here, $18.3 million in the U.S. Okay, maybe it would have done 25. Okay, but.
Well, that's a big difference.
Yeah, I guess. I can't imagine it doing much better than that.
Well, we'll have to see if it has legs.
No pun intended, right? All four of them.
At number 10 is Duckweed. This is a Chinese drama about a father and a son reconciling with each other. It's directed by Han Han, which again, when you're dealing with Mandarin and Cantonese names, it's so hard to know whether it's Han Han or Han Han. But it made $18 million on its opening weekend. Another strong film, not as broad appeal. It's more serious drama, but clearly people flock into the movies and this one found an audience. At number 11 is Hidden Figures, the Oscar hopeful, $15 million over the weekend, $106 million worldwide, and it's just starting to play overseas a little bit. It's in 12 territories now. At number 12 is Confidential Assignment. That's the Korean film about a North Korean investigator and a South Korean detective pairing up together to track down a bad guy. $15 million on this weekend, $23 million total, another movie that's benefiting from the do we call it Chinese New Year? I keep calling it that, but it's celebrated in many Asian countries and communities all over the world. So I don't know if that's the right term.
Spring Festival, I hear often mentioned.
All right.
During the Spring Festival.
At number 13 is Boonie Bears in Tangled Worlds. This is an animated film spun off from a TV series. It's Chinese, and it's the fourth one that we've seen. $14 million on its opening weekend, $17 million total. So it must have opened on Wednesday or Thursday, something like that.
All of that is in China. $14 million. It's number 13th on the list. All of it in China.
Absolutely. Number 14 is Moana, chugging along. It's at $530 million. And number 15 is The King. We talked about this last week. This is a Korean political thriller. Another $10 million. Again, benefiting from the big people flocking to the theaters. $23 million total for that one. Rogue One keeps chugging along. $1,030 million. Lion, the Oscar hopeful, it scored some big nominations. It made $8 million over the weekend, and it's at $40 million worldwide. So it has now tripled its budget. So it's pretty firmly in the black. Can we call it a rare win for the Weinstein Company? They've been a little quiet lately, haven't they?
They have, yes. I don't necessarily know that. I think they stopped making 12 films a year or distributing 12 films a year, and I think that's the reason you're feeling that they're quiet, because they're distributing less film.
There you go. At number 19, I'm going to jump down a little bit, is a Russian film. It's Attraction. It's a sci-fi drama directed by Fyodor Bondarchuk, who's the son of the great Sergei Bondarchuk. And it's a movie about an alien ship, I think like crash landing in the middle of Moscow, and the government declares martial law. It cost about $6 million to make, and it opened to $6 million. So a pretty solid opening for that movie. And
so in Russia, they call that like, a science fiction movie, whereas in the U.S., we call it the news.
Okay. I don't remember seeing on the news about a spaceship crash landing.
No, martial law.
In Chicago, I get it.
Yeah.
At number 20 is T2. It's not a Terminator movie. It's Trainspotting. It's a new movie based on Irvine Welsh's not very good novel that was a sequel to Trainspotting, and that book was called Porno, and this movie is based on that, and it's not very good either. I don't know why they felt obliged to make it, but it made $6.3 million in the UK on its opening weekend. And then down below, one more movie to mention, Rais. I'm not sure how to pronounce this. It's a Bollywood crime drama It cost about $10 million to make, we believe. It opened to about $5.5 million on its opening weekend. This is a movie that's been plagued by problems and political issues not germane to the movie, but like the casting of Pakistani actors and should the theaters show it, and politicians attacking the film's very popular star, Shah Rukh Khan, and just also demands that they donate money to the army because they have a Pakistani actor in the movie, and a movie with a dominant Muslim cast, which is less and less common in Bollywood. It's just and then somebody complained about religious symbols used in the movie, and the filmmakers were like, we're not sure what they're complaining about. We'll try and find out. So this movie has been plagued with problems and issues, kind of not a huge opening weekend, but I think it's a sign of maybe a lot more politicizing of the Bollywood film industry. And these issues aren't going away, I don't think, yet. I think there's a lot of uncertainty and unrest. You've got a populist leader in India, just like we do in the U.S., and that can stir up a lot of anger and political turmoil.
Wait, politics, anger, turmoil? What are you talking about?
The one thing that's interesting here is while Journey to the West, that sequel did not play in North America, this film, Rais, and Kung Fu Yoga, and Buddies in India, all opened in North America.
And so, well, they opened pretty well.
Yeah, I mean, it's playing here in Birmingham. Rais is playing here in Birmingham. It blows my mind still.
You know, every time you tell me that there's a Bollywood film playing in Birmingham, it does blow my mind.
Every week it plays here.
It's unbelievable.
In Bollywood, it's in Birmingham. Well, you know, that's those are the movies that opened up worldwide, and they all had to have a director in charge, right?
And usually that director is me. I try to take on all the films.
Yes, you do. And now you have a new contract, don't you?
Yes, I'm going to sign it later after the show.
I mean, the DGA has a new contract.
Oh, yeah, they have a new contract, too. They're getting some subscription video on demand residuals, in fact.
Well, they've upped them dramatically. I mean, this obviously is the area where money's being made. They're not going to fight over Blu-ray royalties anymore. Now they're going to fight over streaming royalties.
Yeah, and I remember the last contract, they didn't get Blu-ray royalties or DVD royalties, and everybody thought, oh, that's a huge loss. And, you know, at the time we thought, well, it depends on how fast streaming picks up, and it doesn't look like it's going to pick up all that quickly. They may have wanted to kind of focus a little bit more on the physical, the royalties for physical media. Well, boy, were we wrong.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, they're still, you know, selling $1 billion more of Blu-rays, so it's not like there's not money to be divvied up.
True. But I think everybody is kind of squarely focused on streaming.
Right, but if they're making, oh, ignore that $1 billion over here. You know, I'd like a piece of that too.
Yeah, okay. Well, I mean, so what do they get here in the new contract?
Well, they got a higher royalty rate. It went from roughly $15,000 to $50,000 for a 3-year use of your movie in streaming video on demand. This is for like a high budget drama, and it's for movies that are showing or TV shows showing on the highest paying tier. So if you have a free level, I guess you get less money for that. But if it's available to watch on your highest tier without ads and all that sort of stuff, then you're getting $50,000 in a flat rate, I guess, for 3 years of use of that property.
And I wonder if that's like the first 3 years or, you know, well, gee, that movie is like 50 years old and you're not going to get $50,000 for it. You didn't get $50,000 to make the movie in the first place.
I believe this is applying to new movies going forward.
Okay.
As far as what your residuals are for a movie you made 5 years ago, that would, I think, be different. They did set residuals for foreign streaming video on demand. They've done a big bump in high budget features on streaming video on demand. They did a bump for your team. There's not just the director, of course. There's the unit production manager. There's the assistant director. Just as you see with the DGA awards, when they announce who won the award as director, they also list their team, and those people got a bump as well. There's a big bump for 1-hour basic cable dramas. You know, there's a lot of money being made in basic cable. So there's pay increases all around. They're certainly going beyond keeping pace with inflation because money is moving towards streaming video, and that's where they want to have a bigger piece of the pie.
Well, and let's face it, I think a part of this is a makeup for not having any video residuals at all for, you know, 10, 12 years.
Well, they're catching up to reality.
Right, exactly.
I don't think they're saying, well, we feel bad. They're just, the directors are saying, we really want our money now.
Yeah, like you got us before for, you know, since 1997 with the DVDs, we got nothing, okay? But yeah, now this time we're actually wise to your game, so we're not giving up.
Right, but what happened at Sony?
Well, apparently not a lot. Just a lot of they needed some ink, and it just happened to be red. All of it.
I mean, they had a write down of not $1 billion, but $962 million. So close enough, I would say. I guess they didn't want to do a $1 billion write down. And when you say, well, what? Why did they have $1 billion write down? They said, oh, this and that.
Yeah, but what? Like what?
Well, you know, this and that stuff. We love our movies. We love our movies, though. We love them. We're not selling them. We love them. But yeah, we wrote off $1 billion. And they said, well, they referenced their buying of the movie studio decades ago as one of the reasons they had this write down.
Can you do that? Can you do that? Because if you can do that, then I'd like to, you know, I've got some purchases back in, 1998 that I'd like to take off my taxes.
Exactly. And they won't talk to Trump. And they also said that there's been changes in the entertainment landscape, obviously meaning the switch to streaming video on demand and the move away from physical media. And all in all, they said they love the movie studio. They're not going to sell it. TV's doing great, of course. They've just got a new hit with The Crown. And they said this is a goodwill impairment charge, to which I guess I'd hate to see a badwill impairment charge.
Yeah, well, that also means you're probably not paying taxes for the next 20 years. That's a way of saying, you know.
Is that what goodwill impairment charge means? It becomes more of a tax write-off?
Well, no, I don't necessarily know, but I can say that if you have a $1 billion write down, you probably wouldn't take that write down in 1 year. You'd probably stretch it out over, 20, 30 years, if you can.
Unless it gives you an advantage to do it that way.
Correct. Yeah. And so more than likely, this just is a way to offset future taxes or taxes owed.
Right, but they obviously have to have a reason to do it. It'd be nice to have a better idea of, well, things look different now. We're just going to tow off $1 billion. Obviously, you can't get away with that with the IRS. So I'm wondering if there's more to the story. If anybody knows.
Well, they can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. They can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also follow us on Twitter, where our handle is @ShowbizSandbox, or you can like us on Facebook. If you search for Showbiz Sandbox, our page should come up, and people, our listeners do post links to news stories that we cover here on the show. So please do write to us, email us, follow us, like us.
That's right, and I'm sure all our readers watched the PGA Awards, or they read about it. Both the trades, they send you like 37 emails during an award ceremony. Is that really necessary?
No, it's not. And it's annoying and irksome.
If I want that moment by moment, I'm either watching it or I can get your Twitter feed, right?
Right. And frankly, the Twitter feed is enough.
Right. You don't need email. You don't need 17 every 5 minutes. Oh, another award was handed. It's like, I know what's happening. If I want to know, I'll watch it or I'll look at your Twitter feed. It's just ridiculous to fill up our inboxes with. I get like 50 emails in an evening just because there was an award show.
Well, and it's basically using your inbox as a Twitter feed, because really when you open the email, there's nothing more to the story. It's like, right.
They're doing something right. I mean, Hollywood Reporter's won a lot of awards lately. Obviously, I guess they would stop doing it if people stopped subscribing or blocked, got angry, but I don't understand why it's effective or why people don't get annoyed by it.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it would be interesting to ask them, hey, does this work? It might work.
Yeah, well, why? Or maybe it did once upon a time, but now they need to realize that that day has passed. But the PGA Awards passed this weekend. It didn't die. It just happened. And they handed out top awards. Pretty typical what we would have expected. In TV, they acknowledged Stranger Things as best drama and Atlanta as best comedy. And in the movies, the best pictures were La La Land, Zootopia for animated film, and OJ Made in America for best documentary. Don't be surprised if those three are exactly what win come Oscar time.
Not Kubo and the Two Strings.
Obviously, that could well be. I happen to think Zootopia is better, so I'm happening to think that it'll win. But I wouldn't be shocked. I mean, Kubo did get a tech award, but that's because it's a stop motion film. It's the first one since Tim Burton's Nightmare Before Christmas to get an award in one of those tech categories like costumes and set design. And it was well-deserved. And frankly, it should have gotten a few more tech awards, because I did think it was a gorgeously made movie. And that is a craft and a skill. And I'm glad they recognized at least, I think, was it the costumes? No, it was the costumes. I forget whether it was costumes or production. I think it was costumes. They should have recognized it in production design as well.
Yeah, no, but it was recognized for costumes in the... I think it was the PG. I can't remember.
No, it was the, no. I mean, it got an Oscar nomination.
Okay.
It got an Oscar nomination in a tech category, and I believe it was costumes, but it might have been production design.
No, costumes was definite. Costumes was definite.
Costumes is definite. All right. Well, there you go. That was the PGA Awards. A lot of political speeches, obviously. You know, a weekend of a lot of, you know, public protests all over the country. Kind of, you know, we haven't seen this since the 60s.
No, this is,
and look, this is big.
Yeah, I mean, look, Donald Trump has been our president in the United States, something I still, doesn't trip off the tongue, let's put it that way. It still makes me think I'm living in a George Orwell novel. But that said, he has been our president for a week, and boy, I have never seen protests like this. As you know, I wasn't alive in the 60s, so I haven't seen this. This is remarkable.
It is, and but I pointed out just to say, if people always roll their eyes at celebrities talking about politics or this and that, in this case, they're not ahead of the curve or talking about politics when it feels unless it feel it would feel weird if they didn't make these comments. And I feel like they're part of the public conversation now. They're not some outlier over there. So a lot of them made public comments, some interesting, some thoughtful, some just sort of, you know, spoke out. But it is sort of part of what's going on here right now. We'll have to see what happens in France with their election and all that. But, you know, it's not some weird little, oh, look at Hollywood talking politics again. It's what everybody is talking about right now. I can't have a conversation with anyone without talking about politics. Meanwhile, they had the SAG Awards and they blew our minds, didn't they?
Well, when you say they blew our minds, in what way?
Well, you expect Best Actor to be Casey Affleck, but here it was Denzel Washington.
Yes.
You expect Best Picture to be maybe Manchester by the Sea, but maybe Moonlight, but probably La La Land. And instead, they picked Hidden Figures.
Yeah, that did shock me.
And Best Actress, I don't think there is a clear frontrunner yet, but Emma Stone won for Best Actress, so maybe she is the frontrunner now.
Nah, I think she's always been the frontrunner. Like, this is her year. They're going to, you know, Natalie Portman All right. already has an Oscar. Meryl Streep has like three. Emily Blunt, you know, she wasn't even nominated.
Amy Adams wasn't nominated.
Yeah. This year it's really going to be Emma Stone. It's her year.
So the supporting nods were more familiar. I don't know how to say his name. Mahershala Ali.
Yeah, that's actually very good. Yes.
Good. For Moonlight and Viola Davis for Fences. So there was a lot of love for that movie. Two acting awards. Do you think this means Hidden Figures is now a player for the Best Picture win? Or is it just that La La Land does not play to the SAG strength of being an ensemble picture? It's really dominated by two people.
I think it's certainly up there, but I think La La Land is still going to be the overall favorite.
But do you think Hidden Figures is now breathing down its neck, or is it still more likely Moonlight or Manchester by the Sea that's in second and third place?
Oh, no, actually, Hidden Figures, I would say Hidden Figures could surpass Moonlight very easily.
It only has three nominations.
Yeah, but it's one of those.
I think that indicates not a lot of love.
Well, but remember, the way that Best Picture is selected is like kind of through this, you know, everybody voted for it number two, but, you know, just this consensus pick. That's how Spotlight won.
It could be the third consensus pick.
Right, exactly. That everybody picks it as number two. So therefore, it's now number one.
I think there would still be more love for it in other categories. I think it's still just not that strong when you look at how many nominations it got. And maybe Anne can tell us. I'm not sure about whether Taraji P. Henson ran for... Did they push her for Best Actress?
I don't know.
Because I just saw the movie over the weekend, and I'm like, well, she's clearly the lead, and if they're all supporting, I'm not sure why Octavia Spencer got it over her. When I'm having seen the movie, it's clearly her story, Taraji P. Henson's story, her character. And I thought, why is Octavia getting all the award nomination? I guess maybe because she won before.
Maybe, yeah. And by the way, costume design, Kubo and the Two Strings was not nominated.
No, that was for special effects it got a nomination,
yes,
right?
Yes, yeah.
Right. And I thought it would get a nomination for costume design or production design. And instead they went for special effects. But again, stop motion film, well-deserved, an interesting movie, very well-crafted.
Part of the problem here is that I get so many press releases, and I know you do. You have the same issue, Michael. You get like hundreds of press releases every week. And I got like three press releases, I want to say from Focus Features, about Kubo and the Two Strings, and, you know, an offer to interview the costume designer because she was nominated, and it was the first time that, and I must have
in
confused.
Some other
yeah,
ceremony. Yeah,
exactly.
That's okay. It's our job to stay on top of that and not make those mistakes. And that's why we look at the tea leaves of all these award shows to say, who's in the front runner for Oscar now? And so we've had these award shows. We've had a lot of stuff going on over the weekend. And this is why we brought it up, because when we look at these Guild Awards and then we look at the headlines in the newspaper, does this mean we knew who was about to win Best Foreign Film?
Well, you know, as you know, Michael, I have a soft spot in my heart for a German film, Tony Erdmann. Okay. And I hope that it wins. I wish it would win. I don't think it's going to win now.
If it wins, will you buy that crazy, whatever thing that was, that crazy costume?
What, the teeth that, you mean the big giant hairy bear thing?
Yeah, the Yeti like monster broccoli thing, whatever the hell. I forget what it's an indigenous culture thing. I should maybe, but it's crazy looking and exciting. It's very cool, but you should wear that to next Halloween if it wins.
Yes,
promise
and,
now.
I promise I'll wear the fluffy giant. Yeah, I don't know what Bigfoot looking thing that was. It's one of the best parts of the movie, and I don't want to ruin it for you. But
it's just a crazy looking thing. Yeah,
yeah. It's Tony Erdmann, and I say this in all honesty, it is the funniest 2.5 hour German comedy you will ever see. Have you seen it, Michael? Yeah, obviously
yes.
You have. And did you like it?
I did.
Yes,
I respected the acting a lot. I haven't seen it. I'd like to see it twice. But I'm not quite sure how I feel about it, but I certainly respected it and enjoyed the performances a lot.
I guess for me, seeing it in Cannes, not knowing what to expect, I kind of went in going, I guess I'll see this movie. And kind of walked out going, oh my God, that was so pleasant. It was so uplifting. It was nice. It was really touching. But now let's face it. Another film that was in Cannes, The Salesman, this is going to win, I think.
And why is that?
Well, because The Salesman is directed by Asghar Farhadi, who already has an Oscar for The Separation, if you recall, a couple years back.
And people love winners. They love to re-nominate and re-win people who've won before.
And this time they're going to do it just because Asghar Farhadi will not be there, and there's a reason he's not going to show up, and that's because of the ban on visas from certain countries, one of them being Iran, which is where Asghar Farhadi is from.
That's right. Over the weekend, there was the ban, the Muslim ban, though they pretend it's not a Muslim ban, but obviously it is. And it's not really about national security because they eliminated the countries that Trump does business with. So anyway, this political stunt and or whatever you want to call it, ban came into place. Asghar Farhadi said, people said, oh, my God, he won't be able to come here for the ceremony. And he said preemptively, even if someone makes an exception for me, I will refuse to come on principle while this ban is in place. If others can't come, I won't come either. So now the U.S. looks more repressive than Iran. Well done.
Yeah, good job there. Yeah.
But I think that you know, it's a very worthy film. It's a terrific movie from all accounts. I haven't seen it yet, but I'm looking forward to it. He's a terrific director. It's about people putting on a production of Death of a Salesman. If it wins, it will be perfectly honorable and worthy just because it's a good movie. But obviously, Oscar voters are paying attention, and this might just spur them in that direction.
Well, it's certainly going to spur them to see the movie, which is half the battle, right?
There you go. You're exactly right.
But now we also have A Man Called Ove, The Salesman, Land of Mine from Denmark, Tana from Australia, and Tony Erdmann from Germany. So I think between A Man Called Ove, which everybody seems to love,
it's soft. It's a. I don't think that's a big. I mean, you never know with the foreign film, but it's a modest movie. I think. I don't think that's a player, but you never know.
Tony Erdmann and The Salesman. I think. Although it could wind up being Land of Mine out of nowhere.
Yeah, as always. But I think it's a different now because they've broadened it. Right, you don't have to show up to the event and sign off that all 5 movies. You can get the disc and you can see him and say, yeah, I saw him.
Right.
So I think it's a little better now. You don't have that weird quirk where like 40 people saw all 5 movies and that's who vote. So it's been a little better in recent years. It hasn't been so quirky where you're like, what? You know, it picks the one movie nobody's heard of. You know, so the picks are better as far as the nominations. And I think the winner's probably coming down to Tony Erdmann and The Salesman. But it's funny you should mention the Dutch.
Why is that?
Because they're going to come up in the book filter section.
Oh, well, then I guess if that's the case, it must be time for our book filter segment. Book filter is a book lover's best friend. Michael, what's your pick of the week? The book that you've selected with our listeners in mind. And in fact, it's often with listeners who might be development executives.
That's right. I like to do a little side work on the side for development people. There's a couple interesting books out this week. The Evenings is the one I just referenced. It's a Dutch book. It's a classic by Gerard Reeve. It's the first English translation of this book. I think it came out in the right after the war. I forget the year now. Oh, 1947. It was his debut novel. He was one of the most acclaimed writers in their country. This is his classic novel, though he wrote many others. It's an interesting book, sort of a Holden Caulfield type book with a young man who's working and living with his parents and looking with disdain on the world. I enjoyed it. It was an interesting book. There's also a fantasy novel, Crossroads of Canopy, which launches a new fantasy series set in the canopy of a giant forest, 13 kingdoms up in the trees. That's kind of cool. But when you look at the books coming out this week and you're thinking, what should I turn into a movie? How could it be anything but Scores?
Now, when you say that name, I got to tell you, knowing what I've said previously, earlier in the show, Scores, New York City, I immediately think, oh my gosh, is this that Wall Street strip club?
Absolutely. It's a pretty famous strip club. Maybe there's more than one now in New York City called Scores. And this book is by a guy who started it. And the subtitle is How I Opened the Hottest Strip Club in New York City, Was Extorted Out of Millions by the Gambino Family, and Became One of the Most Successful Mafia Informants in FBI History. That's by Michael D. Blutrich. I mean, strippers, the Gambino family, mafia informant. I love it.
Yeah, it's got everything. Crime, sex, mystery.
Crime, sex, and it even has a blurb from, of all people, Anderson Cooper. I'm like, what does he know about Scores? He knows nothing about Scores. But there you go. I think that's my pick of the week.
I get, certainly, I hope Mr. Blutrich there is in the witness protection program. That's all I can say.
And I hope that when the movie's made, we get a thank you in the credits, because that would be pretty cool.
It would be a big deal.
Oh, you're right.
Because it's time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story is about Jack White. Jack White, he's kind of a DIY guy, so it makes sense. He's tired of facing a four-month backlog for any albums he wanted to put out on LP. The once and future White Striper decided to build his own vinyl pressing plant. That's kind of what we all do when we get stuck with something. We just build our own factory. Yes. The Third Man Records vinyl factory goes online in February and will be able to turn out about 5,000 discs every 8 hours. It also adds 50 jobs to Detroit's economy. Once it starts up, there will be just 20 record pressing plants in the United States. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, I don't know. Is that a lot of volume?
Well, for what he's doing, yes.
I don't know what you mean by he. Well, I don't mean his little label. I mean, is compared to the other 19 plants, is that a small plant? Is it a medium plant? Is it a large plant?
It's a small plant for an indie record label that wants to press its own discs.
Well, but I assume they could take other business too.
Yes.
And so they would help with the whole total capacity. It's very cool. I mean, why not if you can do it? How many 8-track plants are there, by the way? Is anybody going to bring 8-track back?
No.
But I think it's cool. And I think with the complete collapse of sales, as we are seeing, and we talked about last week with the Billboard charts, where albums aren't 10,000 copies and you're number one in the country. It's crazy. I think this actually, as I sort of poo-pooed vinyl records when they came, they're not coming back in terms of market share. They're not coming back in terms of this is where people are buying their music, but they are an important revenue stream, certainly in physical product, because that's all that's left. If people want vinyl, sell them vinyl. The real money is in subscriptions, but hey, there's money to be made, and that extra couple bucks means a lot, especially for a smaller company like Third Man Records.
Yeah, when it comes to music and the consumption of music these days, Nielsen Music says that streaming represents 38% of all consumption, which is up from 23% in 2014. How's that for having just facts and figures at my fingertips?
Only 40%? I would think it'd be even higher.
Well, give it some time.
Yeah, all right.
In fact, Sprint is helping the cause. The Sprint telecommunications company here in the United States has purchased 1/3 of Jay-Z's streaming service Tidal, to which Jay-Z said, phew. Now, this raises the question, why would they do that? The service will become, quote-unquote, available to Sprint subscribers, though it was unclear if that meant for a monthly fee or whether that would be for free. Would the streaming service count against subscribers' monthly data cap? Is that even legal? And by the way, it might be under the new FCC chairman, Ajit Pai. So in any case, Sprint brings 45 million customers to the table, while Tidal brings the occasional two-week exclusive on songs or albums from some big-name artists. Maybe. Sometimes. Big deal or big whoop?
I mean, dear God, it seems like a big whoop, but it is utterly confusing, isn't it?
Well, basically, they wanted into streaming. That's basically what they wanted. And they wanted to control something. And so they went for Tidal because they probably couldn't pay enough for Spotify. They couldn't pay enough for any of the other services. And so now they own a part of Tidal.
That does not seem like a good move.
I would agree with you. Actually,
yeah, I'd love to see what the actual numbers are for subscribers, etc. People accuse them of exaggerating them. I don't see the need for it. It hasn't distinguished itself at all, but we'll have to see.
Yeah, I mean, I think, look, I get it, but not with Tidal. And frankly, I wouldn't invest in streaming music right now anyway. There are just too many players. There will be consolidation. Craig Ferguson is a favorite here at Showbiz Sandbox, Michael. You know that. So we've been rooting for him since he stepped down from his late night berth, but we have to admit he seemed a little, lost would be the word. A game show? That's what he was going to do? Okay. A daily syndicated talk show in prime access? It made no sense to us or anyone else, apparently, since it never came to fruition. A seemingly random, poorly thought out attempt to jazz up history with some comics and some experts? Yeah, no thanks. Well, finally, Ferguson has landed on what looks much more promising than any of that. A daily two-hour talk show on Sirius from 6 to 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. It will be free form and very Craig Ferguson, with no need to book celebrity guests shilling their new movie and every need to do stuff that interests and engages Ferguson. It starts February 27th. And is this a big deal or a big deal, Michael? Because really, let's face it, it's a big deal.
It's a big deal. No, I'm very excited. As soon as I heard it, I thought, okay, now you go. That makes sense. I can see that working. I can see that happening. I can see that being a lot of fun. I can see wanting to subscribe to Sirius just to listen to it. That's how much I like Craig Ferguson.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard him on the radio before, which is kind of ironic since he does have a fairly thick Scottish brogue. You know, it's gotten softer over the years, but you'd think, well, how am I going to understand him if I can't see him? But I've heard him on the radio before, and he's a funny guy. He is very funny and very, on point. So it should be very, very interesting, and I will actually search this out.
Yeah, I mean, do you get Sirius?
I do get Sirius, yes.
Well, get Sirius. You get Sirius, okay. Yeah, I mean, I think of him as like a Dick Cavett. He's just a thoughtful, interesting guy. He is funny and spontaneous, but he's also engaging and interesting and has a wide array of interests. And it's a show that when he had interesting guests on, I loved it. I loved his interviewing. There's nobody on Late Night who's a good interviewer right now. Not one. Not one. Some of them have good comedy bits. None of them are good interviewers. Not a single one of them.
I mean, this is a guy who, when he had Madeleine Albright, the former Secretary of State, on his show, he got her to show her tattoo. You know, they talked about, like, oh, you got a tattoo? Hey, I've got a tattoo. Here's mine. And they, like, compared tattoos. I mean, it was just, if you ever saw Madeleine Albright, you'd say, first of all, she has a tattoo. And secondly, you'd go, how in the world did he get this very kind of highfalutin, erudite person who always wearing the brooch and dressed so finely to, she's like royalty in a way. There she is, like, showing off her tattoo on a show. I mean, it was just, he's very, very good. I agree with you. You know what else is good? BBC4, sometimes. BBC4 enjoyed good success with crime dramas from Scandinavia and Australia in recent years, and Dios mío, now they've turned to Spain. Yes, the BBC4 channel has acquired its first Spanish language drama, a 10-part series called I Know Who You Are. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. More and more movies are traveling all over the world. Subtitles is not stopping them. Is not? Subtitles aren't stopping them. We're seeing French dramas in the U.S. The U.S. has been the most resistant to subtitles. But I think it's very healthy. It's good for everyone. I know when my sister's husband, back here in Birmingham, gets obsessed with a telenovela called El Señor de los Cielos, and now he's watching the prequel, El Quema, you know it's a new world.
Holy comic book, Batman! The New York Times announced its slicing back on a bunch of online bestseller lists it creates to cover the publishing industry. Their plans are a little vague, but two things are clear. They're cutting the bestseller list for mass market paperbacks, and they're cutting the list for graphic novels, the stuff that the geek in us still calls, you know, comic books. Needless to say, folks in the publishing business are concerned since fewer charts mean less visibility, especially for areas that often don't get a bright spotlight, like, you know, graphic novels. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. It's not really a big deal. I shouldn't say that. I think it's a big whoop. I don't understand why they did it. I assume they have their survey stuff in place for, you know, speaking to all these stores and how they do their formula, and a lot of it's automated. So I'm not sure. These are just online charts. Why are they cutting them? Is it that much worth an expense to do? You know, I mean, like, so you got a chart for romance, you got a chart for sci-fi, you got a chart for young adult, you got a chart for ebooks, you got a, you know.
Well,
I'm not
probably,
quite sure why they what.
Mm-hmm. They probably also looked at it and said, look, you know, nobody's even accessing these things. Look at the traffic to this. There's like 5 page views a week. Why are we bothering with this?
I don't know that they expected it to drive online traffic, but I felt it was important for the industry and that they were giving the industry a spotlight and covering the industry. And if you look at the last 3 years, the one thing that makes no sense is to cut graphic novels. That category has been a huge area of growth in publishing in 3 years, both commercially and artistically. The Times covers them more and more. And being able to say you're a New York Times bestseller, being able to show that you're on the charts, that is really significant for them. And so that validates the coverage that they've been providing that world of graphic novels, which can be in every genre. They can be journalism, they can be poetry, they can be sci-fi, they can be superhero, they can be, you know, biography, they can be everything. So I don't know why they cut that. That's the one area I wouldn't have cut, because it's the one area that most needs and most deserves its own chart as far as the ones that aren't on the main list, like hardcover and paperback.
Would somebody please hand Jeffrey Katzenberg a pile of money? $600 million? Yeah, that'll do. Seems the former head of DreamWorks Animation has a new venture called Wonderco. That's WNDRCO. And when he asked if anyone wanted to invest in it, they said, yes, please. He raised more than $500 million, and presumably the investors know what he's planning, but we don't have a clue. Big deal or big whoop?
I mean, what is it? Do we still not know?
We still don't know, but I got to tell you, $600 million for a venture, that's a lot of money. You can do a lot with $600 million.
Did he have to tell them what he was going to do?
I'm sure he did. Yes.
So they're like, what are you going to do? Okay. All right. I mean, more power to him. I guess he just doesn't have to tell us.
That's true. He doesn't, because it is a private company.
All right.
So NBC's plans for Megyn Kelly are starting to take shape. And one key decision is integrate Kelly into the Today Show. That's what they're going to do.
Sort of.
Yes.
Yeah.
Rather than launching her and trying to get affiliates to sign on, they're going to put Kelly into one of the hours already devoted to Today. That means either 9 a.m. with Al Roker and Tamron Hall losing out on the gig entirely, or 10 a.m., which would mean Kathy Lee Gifford and Hoda Kotb would move to 9 a.m. Megyn Kelly will also be in primetime, perhaps opposite 60 Minutes, and part of NBC's news coverage overall. So it looks like Megyn Kelly and the Today Show somehow getting together. Big deal or big whoop?
Sort of. It's a big deal. I mean, Today Show has been breathing back down on the neck of Good Morning America. I'm not sure why you'd want to mess with it. I'm not sure why you'd want to take away an hour from what's working really well. They've got 4 hours every day during the weekday, and it's churning out money. So it seems now clearer that they are going to dump the third hour with Al Roker and Tamron Hall. That doesn't mean that she's going to plop in there. To me, it made more sense that she'd be at 9 because she's more harder news. And then at 10 would be the soft news with Megyn Kelly. With Kathy Lee Gifford and Hoda Kotb. But now, apparently, it's going to be 3 hours of Today. And then they're just going to have a new show. She's going to have a live studio audience. It's going to be Megyn Kelly. It won't be branded the Today Show. That's the latest idea of what we think they're going to do. It's not clear yet. It's not written in stone. But that seems to be what they're leaning towards. Certainly, they're not going to mess with Kathy Lee Gifford and Hoda Kotb because they're doing well and making money. So they're going to condense Today to 3 hours and then have Megyn Kelly have the Megyn Kelly Show with a live audience. To me, that's so different from what she's always done. It seems a really big risk. And as opposed to, you know, streaming her into the Today Show, and a big risk to get rid of an hour of Today, which is so profitable. So I don't quite understand it. We'll have to wait and see what they do.
Maybe they're working with Jeffrey Katzenberg.
Maybe Wonderco with Megyn Kelly.
Well, maybe, Michael. But that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball. And Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And as we threatened at the top of the show, we are going to be speaking with Ann Thompson, editor-at-large of IndieWire. And, well, this week's story, how will it affect you? Well, I guess you're going to be watching a whole bunch of interesting movies, according to Ann Thompson and her team over at IndieWire. Ann, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
All right, Ann, one word we had, I think we've had it in the last year or two, is Sundance has too many films.
You know, the thing about Sundance that's just brutal for anybody covering it, you know, trying to get a handle on it, is that there's just too many world premieres for any single person, no matter how many movies they see a day, to actually necessarily see all the right ones. I was talking to Todd McCarthy, the critic at The Hollywood Reporter, who was sort of complaining that he had lined up all the wrong movies. And he's a critic, so they have a schedule that they have to follow. What's great about me and our team, and we can sort of, some of the critics do have assignments, but with, you know, you could sort of feel the buzz and figure out where the word is going, and you can just impulsively run across to the library and see, you know, whatever it is, Ingrid Goes West or you know, the David Lowery A Ghost Story or whatever. And you know, you don't have to see every acquisitions title at the Eccles. You can play around a little bit and try to catch the right ones. And this year, I didn't have to do that many interviews, so I felt like I caught more of the right ones than usual.
It sounds like the same that you would face at any other film festival like Cannes or Toronto. I mean,
but
so
in the case of Sundance, there's more American acquisitions, commercial titles that are actually going to go into the marketplace here. In Cannes, it's a smaller list.
And I guess, you know, here's an acquisition from last year, Manchester by the Sea. And I probably should have started off by saying that we were talking to you, Anne, about this year's Sundance Film Festival, but I guess I skipped that part. And every year at Sundance, as you mentioned, there are tons of acquisitions. But these days, you have a number of companies looking, not only Fox Searchlight and Focus Features and the usual theatrical distributors.
Suspects.
Yes. But you also have some streaming suspects, some SVOD, subscription video on demand suspects, like Netflix or Amazon Prime. Has that changed the way the industry approaches these festivals?
What's going on is that Netflix and Amazon Prime are hungry. They need to feed a big gaping maw. They want original content. Netflix wants to put that red banner of original Netflix content on their movies, and Amazon wants product too, and they have the deep pockets to drive the prices way, way up. Now, Amazon, in my view, with Manchester by the Sea, proved that they could push, with the help of a theatrical distributor as savvy as Roadside Attractions, a movie right into Oscar contention. They got the commercial playing time perfectly right. They got the reviews. They got everything right. And so it's a major contender with 6 Oscar nominations, including Best Picture and Best Actor, which it'll probably win. But, you know, Netflix, which just picked up Mudbound, which was the highest costing acquisition of the festival, Netflix has to sort of pay a premium because they haven't proven that they can take care of an Oscar campaign or really nurture a movie theatrically. That's not what they do. That's not their business. So I'm very curious and a little concerned, because I liked Mudbound very much, Dee Reese's new movie about 2 conflicted Southern families after World War II. It's very ambitious. It's very beautiful, but it needs careful handling. And I just don't know if throwing it out there on Netflix, it's not the same as a documentary. It's not the same as, you know, having a week in theaters and then advertising the hell out of something so everyone wants to see it. I don't know how it's going to work.
Well, I was a big fan of Dee Reese and her earlier movie, Pariah. I interviewed her about that. And I was excited for this movie. I was excited by the reviews. And then I saw Netflix picked it up and I thought, oh, well. Is that fair? I mean, they're not even trying to do movies theatrically. Are they saying today, no, we're going to make a theatrical push with this movie? Or are
yes,
they
are.
They think
that
it's a problem?
That is exactly what they're saying. And so the question becomes, how are they going to achieve that? With whom are they going to partner? And, you know, that's the story that remains to be proven. In other words, they need to do what Amazon did. Now, Amazon has a whole team of people who are theatrical veterans who work there, people like Bob Burney and Ted Hope and Scott Foundas and people like that who know exactly how to do this. I don't think that anyone at Amazon really does know. I would argue that the doc side, again, they picked up a lot of good documentaries too. Icarus is very good. Chasing Carl is very good. But I don't know. I do not know. And Amazon, I believe it was Amazon that picked up the movie that I like a lot, City of Ghosts, which is very good. And so there, you know, there's a lot of good docs. There's always a lot of good docs that go all the way to the Oscars. Yeah, Amazon got City of Ghosts. So they were sort of duking it out throughout the festival, spent the most money of anybody, outspent the studios, and ended up with some of the best movies, arguably.
Well, and it seems to me that these days, one of the aspects you have to look at is what is a theatrical release? What film constitutes a theatrical release, and which ones should go straight to, you know, Netflix or Amazon or streaming? Are studios and these streamers, as I will call them, are they taking that into consideration?
I think they are. It's just that some are proven and some are not proven. And I think that the theatrical companies are more dependent on making movies from that particular market. And they have, you know, Amazon and Netflix have different goals. They're trying to bring people to the site or add subscribers or, you know, they have different goals in mind, you know, shopping, eyeballs. Whereas the theatrical distributors are still trying to do the old fashioned theatrical thing. You could argue that if Fox Searchlight picks up Patty Cakes or Sony Pictures Classics picks up this extraordinarily good Call Me By Your Name, that these movies are going to have a real shot at real recognition, real brand name awareness, a real chance at making it in theaters. Beasts of No Nation that Netflix released theatrically in a very perfunctory, quickie kind of way never got that kind of identification, and therefore it didn't have a chance with the Oscars.
You just mentioned two films, Call Me By Your Name and Patty Cakes. Those were some of the big buzz films, weren't they?
Yeah. So Patty Cakes ended up going for, I think, $10 million to or $9 million to Fox Searchlight, and that's the one with the young woman from New Jersey who's a rapper, and it has the wonderful, wonderful Raging Bull, Kathy Moriarty playing her grandmother. And it's just a wonder. This girl, Danielle McDonald, is just a great breakout star. She's from Australia, and she's just fantastic in this movie. But again, you know, Searchlight probably ended up paying more than they would have wanted to get the movie. And even good old Sony Pictures Classics was paying $5 or $6 million for their movies that they bought.
So you were talking to some people about what they're looking for in terms of visibility for their films, and that has changed over the years, obviously. And you spoke with Paul Davidson at The Orchard or The Orchid.
The Orchard.
And he was saying, hey, look, you know, being on 2 screens or 10 screens, that's meaningless to us. We've got to be on 50 to 400 screens. We've got to be reviewed in all the top markets. That's what you need to have a theatrical release that means something as far as raising the visibility of your film that maybe has no big name stars, right?
Right, exactly. And that is the argument that theatrical distributors are making to the filmmakers when they're in the room trying to convince them to go with them instead of going with one of the streaming companies. The streaming companies are going to throw more money at it. But is that going to do, especially an emerging filmmaker, someone who isn't well known, who wants to get their name across, you know, who wants to build a career? You know, that is an interesting question, I think.
Now, you mentioned Patty Cakes. Certainly, we heard a lot about that for those of us who didn't attend the festival. You also mentioned Call Me By Your Name. What was this film about? Because it seems to have gotten a lot of social media love.
Call Me By Your Name is the one that popped in a way because it was so different from all the others. Luca Guadagnino, the Italian filmmaker, he's made quite a few films. He the most recent one was A Bigger Splash with Tilda Swinton and Ralph Fiennes. And this movie is set in Italy. It's in this lush, beautiful summer, elegiac kind of setting, a wealthy family with a beautiful house. And the father is played by Michael Stuhlbarg. He's an academic, and he has always every summer, he has a researcher come for the summer and work with him. And his younger son, Elio, the teenager, he falls in love with Armie Hammer. The guy is like gorgeous. He's like Robert Redford. He's golden. Everybody thinks he's wonderful. And there's this beautiful love story that takes place over the course of a summer. And everyone just went wild for this movie. And I think it'll go a long way.
Well, I've already purchased stock in apricots. So that movie is based on a novel by Andre Aciman, and it's a terrific novel, and I'm looking forward to the movie. He also did I Am Love. But you talked about how people are paying more and more for movies, and yet, ironically, it seems like the budgets for a lot of the movies making it to Sundance, there's a downward pressure on them. Why is that happening?
Yeah, that's true. That is true. Christine Vachon was explaining that, you know, 5 is the new 10, 3 is the new 5, 1 is the new 3. And it's true that it, just in terms of being able to raise the money to make a movie based on whatever cast you can get, it varies. And it's very hard to spend the kind of money that used to come your way. I mean, it feels like it's not that hard to get movies made, but it certainly is hard to get them made at a higher price.
And by the way, Michael, I think Anne was going to tell you that it wasn't apricots, it was a peach emoji that made a lot of headlines out of Call Me By Your Name.
No, but, it's apricots.
Really?
Isn't it?
In the book?
It's an apricot, yeah.
Not in the movie.
Ooh. Oh, it's a, so there's it's a one peach. Difference.
Oh.
It's now, a peach.
Now, another headline grabber was The Big Sick. This is a I don't know whether it's a comedy or a romantic comedy. Did you get to see that film?
Oh, yeah. The Big Sick is one of my favorites, my absolute favorite, in fact, because it's based on a true, real-life, cross-cultural romance between Kumail Nanjiani and his wife, Emily, and they actually tell the story of their romance in this movie, and Michael Showalter does a great job with it. And I mean, it's a very good movie, and I think that it will do very well because it's funny and tragic and real and authentic and beautifully executed all at the same time. And I think it could go far too. And that's one that Amazon picked up for $12 million.
Well, I blame Stephen Garrett, who cuts film trailers. He told me it was an apricot. He's there. He loved the movie, as he loved I Am Love, one of his earlier films. And he lied to me. He said, it's not that obvious slutty peach. It's an apricot. And so I apparently have cornered the apricot market when I should have cornered the peach market.
Call Me By Your Name, Peach.
No, you're right. It's peaches. I've looked it up now, so I'm wrong.
and I will tell you that if you want to know what any of them are talking about, and I most certainly do, you're going to have to see Call Me By Your Name when it's released in theaters.
Quite a variety, it is a peach. Yes,
but he says that he insists they were talking a lot about apricots in the film. I don't know why. But it looks like it was a good year for movies, though. I have to admit, there's often at Sundance you find out, oh, yeah, there's all these movies. Everybody talks about them, and then we never hear of them again. It feels like there's a lot of movies this year that are going to get seen and heard about.
I couldn't agree more. We're going to hear from these. I think it was a good year. I think it was a very good year. It wasn't necessarily a year for Oscar contenders, by the way. A lot of the films that we just talked about are absolutely going to do well, by the way, but I don't feel like they're all on the level of a Manchester that's necessarily going to get, you know, real nominations at the end of the day.
Well, I mean, coming out
of the docs will.
Yeah, they always do. But coming out of last year's Sundance Film Festival, everybody thought The Birth of a Nation was, you know, Oscar bound.
Look, You and I, all three of us know that there were circumstances that intervened. I was very happy at the end of the day that the DGA gave Nate Parker that first-time filmmaker nomination, because I think he deserved it. I think he put 10 years of his life into a movie, killed himself, and made a good film. Did he handle his scandal well? Was he a good boy in college? No. But I think he did direct a good movie. All of the things that were supposed to happen would have had to have smoothly unfurled for that to have taken place. And Searchlight knew what it was doing, but it didn't happen that way.
Well, now, I know you don't want to equate sexual assault with being naughty, so I know that's not your intention. So we're not talking. We're not really going into what happened then.
Naughty. I'm saying he was on trial. Yeah. For a very serious crime.
Very serious. I've never seen less attention paid to the award winners for Sundance, however, because movies like Call Me By Your Name and Mudbound were not eligible because they were not in competition. They weren't in play. And so the grand jury prize went to I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore. And the audience award, which is usually seen as the big award, went to Crown Heights.
Both of those films I missed. But it wasn't like everybody was telling me to go see them either.
Why do you think awards, I don't want to say they don't matter at Sundance, but this year, really, you're hearing very little about the awards, and really the award is, hey, you got picked up.
I would say that, yes, that is the prize. The prize is to get picked up and to get released.
Well,
the tradition at Sundance, I mean, there are some exceptions like Fruitvale or something, but the tradition is over the years, Beasts of the Southern Wild. Those are films that won jury prizes and went on to grand glory, as did Manchester by the Sea. But there are plenty of films that have been jury prize winners that never got heard from again. It's not unusual.
Well, we were talking about what films and performances we might hear about from this year's Sundance at next year's Oscars. This year's Oscars kind of got a little bit of a push. We talked about the PGA and SAG Awards earlier in the show, but we were a little shocked that Denzel Washington won over either Casey Affleck or I want to say Ryan Reynolds. I keep saying that, Ryan Gosling.
Okay, so going into the SAG Awards, I was predicting that Fences would do very well at SAG. I thought it would win the ensemble, since La La Land wasn't in that mix. And given the strength of Washington and Davis, and it just went differently. So Washington beat out Casey Affleck in that group. I knew Fences was popular with that group. I didn't know how popular Hidden Figures was, but I don't know that that will translate entirely to the Academy. At the Academy, it has three nominations, including Best Picture, and that just doesn't indicate enough support through all the categories for it to end up winning Best Picture.
Well, so that's what I said, Moonlight. But Sperling argued it's the second consensus choice, perhaps.
Well, I think that you'd have to have more nominations for that to be true. I would say that Moonlight has 8 nominations and is a more serious movie. And if the Academy, which I think they do, judging from the way that the PGA and SAG has behaved, if they want to send a message, a similar inclusive, up yours, Donald Trump kind of message, they might go with Moonlight. I wouldn't be surprised. It may be La La Land still. 14 nominations is hard to overlook.
It's going to be La La Land. I have a technical question. Were the filmmakers behind Hidden Figures positioning Taraji P. Henson for Best Actress?
They were.
Oh, so that's why Octavia Spencer got the love and she got overlooked.
That's right, because that Best Actress category was simply too crowded. They didn't even get Annette Bening and Amy Adams in there. So with Arrival, right? Arrival is a very popular movie. She's been nominated 5 times, Amy Adams.
And do you think there's any beating Emma Stone this year?
No, Emma Stone will win.
So that's kind of her knighting.
Yeah, that's a fait accompli. And I think it is between Casey Affleck and Denzel Washington.
You have to choose.
Right.
Well, wait a second. What happened to Ryan Gosling?
He wasn't ever going to win Best Actor.
Really? Man, that guy just can't cut a break.
La La Land is going to do very well, but it's not going to, I don't think it's going to rival Ben-Hur or Titanic or anything. I mean, it's going to win some, and then Manchester will win some, and Moonlight will win some. And maybe Octavia Spencer, you know, has a run, but Viola Davis has to win that category. I don't see it going any other way. Mm-hmm.
So this year really is Oscars so diverse.
Of course.
Yes. Well, certainly we look forward to speaking with you the day after the Oscars, as we always do, to hear about your trip to down the red carpet. Are you going into the auditorium this year or into the press room?
I mean, I've been very lucky to be able to go, I think, almost 3 years in a row now to the actual event. So I'm sharing love, and I'm going to do the red carpet and the backstage press room this year.
Okay, well, we look forward to hearing all about it right after the Oscars. And Ann Thompson, editor-at-large at IndieWire, thank you for joining us to talk about this year's Sundance Film Festival.
Bye.
Bye.
Well, that was good of Ann to stop by. I have to admit, this is the first time in a long time, if ever, I've thought, gee, I wish I was at Sundance this year. There seem to be 10 or 12 very interesting, good movies, and more if you count documentaries, that I'd like to check out.
You know, I could have told you that that was going to happen. Actually,
how
I could
so?
Have told, because I wasn't there this year. It's one of the very, very few years.
So you knew it would be a gem of a year.
Yeah, I said, well, I can't go this year, which means that it's going to be phenomenal. Everything's going to get picked up for $20 million, and all of the Academy Award winners will be, you know, screened at Sundance, you know, and feels otherwise. But, you know, it's always disappointing not to go.
Well, that moves us from inside baseball right into obituaries, and we have breaking news. Do you know who just died? The Doctor. The Doctor died, or at least he's going to die by the end of the year. And of who? I'm talking about Doctor Who, of course, because there's just been a notice that Peter Capaldi, the current Doctor, will be leaving after the current season, which is 10 episodes that starts airing in the UK in April. Then there'll be a Christmas special, a holiday special in December, and then that's it. He's leaving. The showrunner, Stephen Moffat, is leaving. So it's going to be a whole new crew yet again, so we can start the frenzy over who's going to be the next Doctor.
I want to be the next Doctor. It could
I'd
be
love
anybody.
To be the next Doctor. Could be a woman.
That's true. Could be.
But, you know, we'll have to see. It'll be interesting.
Unfortunately, we did lose some actors and actresses this week. We lost Emmanuel Riva, an Oscar-nominated A Star for Amour.
That's right. A terrific movie. We saw that movie at Cannes. She was 89 years old. Her first movie was, of course, Hiroshima Mon Amour. That's where she broke through big time. And then late in her career, another lovely grace note. I mean, it's always nice to end on a strong suit like that, isn't it?
Oh my gosh, that is such a touching and moving movie. No pun intended. It's amazing. Everybody should see this movie.
Another major actor who died was John Hurt, the Oscar-nominated star of Elephant Man. He was in Alien, Midnight Express, the Harry Potter movies. He's been a doctor. He's been Doctor Who. He was in I, Claudius. One of my favorite TV shows, Jim Henson's Storyteller, which retells myths and fables from the past and original ones. Very good show. One of my favorite memories on stage is seeing him in Crap's Last Tape, the Beckett play. I was in London with my friend Robin, and it's early evening, and we had a bite, and then we were going to go to the play. And neither of us was that familiar with London at the time. She pulled out a Baedeker, looked at it for a second, put it away, started striding, and went like across London, right to where the theater was, without ever looking at the map again. London! London is really confusing. I've never been more impressed in my life. And so every time I hear of John Hurt, I think of Robin. I go, damn, she did a good job. And we still talk about that. She's like, that was good. You know, it was not an easy route, believe me. And we were there in a tiny theater seeing John Hurt do that, and it was just magical.
Well, now, what are your thoughts on Mary Tyler Moore? She also passed away this week at the age of 80. She she revolutionized women in television, according to some and according to pretty much everybody.
Well, she died last week, right as our show was being recorded, I think like the end of it. Last week was a bad week. You had a power outage. We were waiting for the Oscars, and we couldn't post it for 2 days. So bummed about that. We'll try to get this one out quicker. And so she had already died. It should have been in there last week. We missed it. So there's been tons of talk about her. My mom's like, my God, you think she should be canonized? There's so much attention. But when someone comes into your home every week for years and years in a great, great show, you really feel a bond with them. Two great sitcoms to her name, The Dick Van Dyke Show, often considered easily one of the 20 or 30 best sitcoms of all time, and The Mary Tyler Moore Show, which I personally would say is the greatest sitcom of all time, a show that started off very good and got better and better and better every season, left when it was on top, but produced 7 seasons of episodes. It's just a tremendous show in every way. So, you know, she was a heck of a talent.
Well, and, you know, I tried to figure out where I could watch some of the old Mary Tyler Moore episodes, and the only place I could find them was on Hulu.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so of
course.
Well,
they've been all over in syndication. I mean, I grew up with that great Saturday night of TV. One brief moment, it was MASH, and All in the Family, Mary Tyler Moore, Bob Newhart, and The Carol Burnett Show. There were other shows in that mix over the years. I think that was for like a few weeks that that happened, but one of the great lineups of all time.
You schlock. All of it is schlock.
Yeah. You know, you can talk about how great TV is now. You can watch any of those shows right now and be like, wow, you know, that's really good television.
Well, speaking of good television, this is a little bit of a DVR alert, okay? Remember, our good friend David Wilde is working on the Grammys right now.
That's February 12th, right?
Yes, but I just, you know, just a heads up, set your DVRs. But then, 2 days later, he's going to be doing the Bee Gees salute.
Ooh, now I wonder how that happened, that they were doing a Bee Gees salute this year, because we just spoke about how the Bee Gees catalog got picked up, and they were talking about how to bring them back into the public eye. Now here you have it, 2 days after the Grammys, a big splashy primetime special tribute to them. That's interesting.
Yeah, and I hope David is able to join us after the Grammys this year, because, of course, he will be working with James Corden, as opposed to LL Cool J, who he's worked with in the past.
Oh, that's cool. Doesn't he have to appear on us or our show? Doesn't he have to show up?
I think it's part of the contract. When you do the Grammys, you have to. Yeah, I think.
What are we paying for if not to have him show up after the Grammys?
Well, we're all on favored nations here, so he gets paid as much as we do, which is.
Wow. Yeah. Very impressive.
Yeah. Well, we get this. We save a lot of money on paper. Actually, we don't have to print any checks at all.
That's right. That's right. So, you know, and if you love the show, you should subscribe to it, shouldn't you?
That's right. You can subscribe in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can usually find our show, and you can rate and review the show in those podcast aggregators. It does help us out when you do. You can email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. That information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you can find links to all of the stories we discussed on today's episode, as well as links to the work of Ann Thompson from IndieWire. I'd like to thank her for joining us to talk about this year's Sundance Film Festival. We'll place links to her work, as well as her Twitter account, in our show notes on showbizsandbox.com. You can follow us on Twitter, in fact, @ShowbizSandbox is our handle, or you can like us on Facebook, just search for Showbiz Sandbox, and up our page should come. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week, unfortunately, it's iheartapricots.com, which apparently is not the website I wanted to have.
No.
Apparently, I wanted iheartpeaches.
Well, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not head on over to, I don't know, the Huffington Post, or you can head on over to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Of course, don't forget about bookfilter.com. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.